Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 420, recorded on Sunday, April 3rd, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Boise, Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So there's been a number of recent episodes or episodes further back where we were talking about themes that touched on issues of electricity and electromagnetism and so forth. But we had kind of always been dancing around it because we know that the topic of electrification is obviously like a huge one in the history of the Second Industrial Revolution, and particularly the second phase of the Second Industrial Revolution. But we had been mostly trying to avoid talking about it because it is such a huge topic. But we're going to get some of that groundwork laid today by talking about kind of the lead-in to that period. Basically, we're going to be covering from the beginning of the 1800s, so pretty much right on the dot, 1800, through about, 1880s. You might be aware of the current war that started in 1888, and then, of course, the big electrification wave starts in the 1890s. So we're not going to go that far because that's going to be kind of our end point for this episode. But we are going to try to talk about sort of the background of how they got up to that point, because that felt like a manageable thing that we could bite off and chew on a little bit today. Although both of us felt a little bit out of our depth as well on some of the science here, as we're not electrical engineers and so forth. But this episode is also going to be a little bit different than some of the other ones we've done, because rather than focusing on American stuff, for the most part, it's going to be focusing on non-Americans and their inventions that were very enthusiastically adopted by the Americans and, of course, had a profound influence on the American economy of the early part of the, the mid part of the 19th century. But these things all play into the eventual situation, which does become very American, as the rest of the Second Industrial Revolution generally was. So we're going to be emphasizing the things that were around before that sort of current war era that starts in the late 1880s, things like arc lighting and coal gas lighting, as well as in-house factory power generators without grid connectivity. We're going to talk about things like telegraphs and how they were powered, all of these sort of things before you get to the full era of electrifications with a grid and, streetcars and everything else, right? So this is our sort of prologue to all of that. We're thinking that probably we're going to do some upcoming episodes. They might not be, because of some scheduling issues, they might not be the immediate next set of episodes, but we're going to eventually talk about those things like urban electrification in the 1890s, the off-peak power production issues that tie into the electric street railways, and then, of course, we'll get into themes like rural electrification, the Tennessee Valley Authority, things like that, that happened sort of much later in, the second or even third phase of the Second Industrial Revolution before we get to what we hope will probably, conclude that sort of arc of narrative, which is the beginnings of the electronics industry, as opposed to, electrification and electricity utility industry, things like transistors, early computing, the internet, and specifically rural internet, with, of course, very obvious parallels to the issues that had been seen in rural electrification. But we got to start back at the beginning of the story, talking about the transition from electrochemistry to electromagnetism over the course of the period of the 19th century from 1800 to about 1865 and the 1870s. So I'm going to start by talking about the electrochemistry era, and then we're going to go bounce back and forth between me and Rachel on this. So in order to do anything technologically useful with electricity, there needed to be a way to create it and or store it. Obviously, you know, people have been doing experiments like Ben Franklin with the key and the kite and all of that, right? But that's different from actually applying it. So later in the episode, as I said, we'll talk about electromagnetism as the breakthrough that unleashes the full power, no pun intended or pun intended, however you want to look at it, of the Second Industrial Revolution. But first, we need to talk about the electrochemistry work of the First Industrial Revolution. So most of both of those topics are actually based on experiments conducted outside the United States, which is, as I said, not something we usually focus on for this show, but it's extremely important foundational work that makes possible all of the technologically driven economic advances of the United States during the 19th century. So let's go back to the beginning, not the, you know, not the beginning, but the beginning of what we would recognizably see as the industrial processes and influences involved here. So Italian scientist Alessandro Volta created the first battery in 1800, even though most of his understanding of how it worked was basically wrong. That made it difficult initially to correct some of the problems with that early battery, but various scientists kept working the problem. And in the meantime, Volta's battery was at least good enough to study electricity and its potential uses in a controlled way. And that also separates it from the earlier, more haphazard experiments with electricity. Eventually in 1836, English chemistry professor John Frederick Daniell, teaching for the East India Company's military wing, invented the Daniell cell, which was about to become the basis for the first wave of very limited electrification in industrializing economies. To quote from the Wikipedia page on the history of the battery, the Daniell cell, quote, consists of a copper pot filled with a copper sulfate solution in which is immersed an unglazed earthenware container filled with sulfuric acid and a zinc electrode. The earthenware barrier is porous, which allows ions to pass through but keeps the solutions from mixing. The Daniell cell was a great improvement over the existing technology used in the early days of battery development and was the first practical source of electricity. And I want to pause here and say that's the important part to emphasize here is it's not just for storage. It's also for literally generating electricity, although we wouldn't call it that because it's not a generator. It's a chemical process, and that's going to become an important distinction as well. But this is a power source for electricity. Quote, it provides a longer and more reliable current than the voltaic cell, which was Volta's project, and it is also safer and less corrosive. It has an operating voltage of roughly 1.1 volts. It soon became the industry standard for use, especially with the new telegraph networks, end quote. So that is sort of the fundamental thing when we're talking about this type of battery is its relationship to telegraphy. This battery was an example of electrochemical power. From the mid-1830s through the 1860s, various people were adding certain refinements or tweaks to the design of the Daniell cell, but the underlying acid battery with a relatively weak output was the same thing, more or less, during this period. For example, Welsh scientist William Robert Grove developed the Grove cell in 1839, which was also acid-based, but included a very expensive platinum component and almost doubled, although that's not very much, the voltage per cell. The Grove cell variant ended up being preferred by the Americans and Canadians. We talked a fair bit about the limitations of telegraphy in our April 2021 episode on the transatlantic telegraph cable, which was eventually laid with a very brief success in 1858 and then laid again more successfully in 1866. One of the challenges all telegraphy faced was a weak signal that faded over distance. On land, this was addressed with relay systems to essentially boost the signal or repeat it, but this wasn't an option for the transatlantic cable, so that was a huge problem for them. But one thing that we didn't really get into too much in that episode was the power source for all this telegraphy, which was, you know, revolutionizing communications and the operations of long-distance multi-jurisdiction businesses. You can't get to that Second Industrial Revolution, you know, multi-state, multi-country business model without having the telegraph system. And the answer to that question or problem is that these acid-based Daniell cell or Grove cell batteries or their variants was providing the power, but not very much, right? So large banks of them were arrayed at telegraph offices to generate sufficient voltages to maintain long-distance pulses of dots and dashes on multiple parallel wires at a time, or just one or two cells if you were in a little office with only a couple of wires. The acid batteries also apparently had a nasty side effect of venting noxious gases into the vicinity, nitric oxide in the case of the Grove cells, which was not ideal for the staff working in the telegraph office, and it's a big no-no under modern OSHA standards. If they were lucky, they might have ventilation pipes carrying the fumes out of the building, but often they did not, and it was pretty rough. A modified Danielle cell from France called a gravity cell because of its use internally of a different specific gravity of various component ingredients was developed in the 1860s and replaced Grove cells as the preferred telegraphy battery power source, not only because it produced more current, but also because it didn't vent dangerous gas to all its surroundings. It did, however, require continuous operation or else it would fail permanently. So these were pretty finicky technologies. In general, these first Industrial Revolution wet batteries, as opposed to modern dry batteries, for telegraph systems, had pretty short lives and had to be replaced every several weeks or so, and obviously they weren't rechargeable in any way like modern batteries would be, or I should say many modern batteries would be. A lot of the people during the period of the 1830s to the 1860s were continuing to work on ideas for totally different battery concepts or electricity generation sources. But for this period that we're talking about, 1830s to 1860s, telegraphy was the only meaningfully omnipresent use of electricity in industrializing countries at the time. Again, telegraph wires were a simple low-current technology that didn't really require huge amounts of power. A 2-volt battery cell was often enough to run a 20-mile telegraph wire connection, and you could throw on some more cells to juice it a bit more. By contrast, almost any other practical application of electricity probably would need much more power than even an efficient mid-19th century battery could reasonably and cost-effectively deliver. We could, and eventually maybe will, do a whole episode on Second Industrial Revolution batteries or 20th and 21st century batteries, but in this episode we're trying to follow the early electrification story, so it's time now to turn away from the electrochemistry and turn to the electromagnetism and power generators. So before we move on, Rachel, did you want to comment on any of this electrochemistry stuff? To my mind, a little bit hard to wrap our heads around and really quite primitive and limited in its ability to do much.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to point out is the fact that the current or the movement of the ions in these cell batteries is only moving one way. And so this is an example of direct current generation. So we're going to talk about direct current and alternating current. So I just wanted to point out that this is an example of direct current. There is a constant stream of ions moving in one direction, albeit a very weak current. So I just wanted to point out that's the definition of a direct current. I'm hoping these concepts won't be like too hard to wrap your minds around. It took a little bit of absorption to really kind of get the concepts. So pointing out the direct current, we'll talk about alternating current later on in the episode.
So as I said, we've got to move on at this point in the story of electrification to talk about electromagnetism. So, you know, obviously, there was lots of research and experimentation and theorizing about all these, related topics, electricity, magnetism, light, and other rays. And that had been going on for literally thousands of years, but especially during the 17th century, the 18th century, and so on. And there was some sense among the people doing research and experiment that these were related in some way to each other and influenced each other. But they weren't really unified as a complete system until the 1860s. And the 1870s. So, Rachel, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of the key breakthrough that, you know, it's not really new ground per se, but it's putting it all together in a way that can't really be refuted much more clearly describes the world around us and how these things are all part and parcel of the same thing, not distinct phenomena.
Right. So in 1865 and 1873, Scottish scientist James Clerk Maxwell had the paramount breakthroughs that it was all the same thing. So in 1865, James Clerk Maxwell publishes his landmark paper, A Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Field, in which Maxwell's equations demonstrated that electric and magnetic forces are two complementary aspects of electromagnetism. He showed that the associated complementary electric and magnetic fields of electromagnetism travel through space in the form of waves at a constant velocity of 3.0 × 108 meters per second. He also proposes that light is a form of electromagnetic radiation and that waves of oscillating electric and magnetic fields travel through empty space at a speed that could be predicted from simple electrical experiments. Using available data, he obtained a velocity of 310,740,000 meters per second and stated, quote, "This velocity is so nearly that of light that it seems we have strong reason to conclude that light itself, including radiant heat and other radiations, if any, is an electromagnetic disturbance in the form of waves propagated through the electromagnetic field according to electromagnetic laws," end quote. And then in 1873, Maxwell published a treatise on electricity and magnetism, which states that light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. So he really tied all these concepts that people were researching together and really kind of came up with this unified theory of how electricity, light, and magnetism worked.
Really ran all the numbers, and also, much like some of these earlier researchers, was able to predict things that hadn't been figured out yet, but just like by inference, well, there's probably also this thing, you know, and so various as yet undiscovered and forms of light that we can't in fact see, radiation of various kinds, you know, that becomes a thing to look for, essentially.
Right.
So as with Volta's battery from 1800 that Volta himself didn't really understand, there were inventors already working on the relevant electromagnetic technologies prior to Maxwell kind of cracking the science on electromagnetism. The legendary English scientist Michael Faraday, who often personally knew and collaborated with some of the inventors we already discussed in terms of electrochemistry, and whose research laid most of the observational foundations of Maxwell's theories on electromagnetism slash light, was working on experimental magnetic dynamos back in the 1830s, although these were hand-cranked, which is, of course, not all that useful in terms of industrial applications. Later, larger iterations of these were literally horse-powered. So if you're wondering, you know, why we call things horsepower and so forth and measure it that way, there was a phase where there was electricity being generated with horse-powered dynamos. And early dynamos used permanent magnets instead of what ended up being more effective, which was electromagnets. And therefore, this dynamo technology, which could actually, you know, was a power source, as was batteries, but in a mechanical way, essentially, or a physics way, this technology was refined significantly in 1866, as and shortly after the breakthrough on electromagnetic science happened. And this refinement essentially unlocks non-battery electric power generation. And so this is where we start getting into this concept of generators, as opposed to just a, you know, something that's almost like a fuel cell, but for electricity, right? So so we got to talk about how we generate power. And then, of course, we got to talk about, well, what would it even be used for? And so before we get into the sort of widespread use, we should emphasize here that a lot of factories were the earliest ones to start doing dynamos of various kinds. Things like those horse-powered dynamos would have been factory applications, right? They weren't there. You didn't have significant amounts of street lighting at this point. You didn't have people with lighting in their homes and refrigerators and all of that, of course, right? That's much later. But in that sort of late phase, you know, right before these kind of big breakthroughs in electromagnetism and so forth, you do get these sort of more mechanically powered dynamos to help out with certain things in factories. And it was a little bit hard for us to find some of the details on this, so I'm kind of only mentioning it in passing, but I do just want to like bridge that gap that there was some use of electricity that was not battery-based telegraphy and was before the more conventional power generators and grids and power plants and things that we're about to talk about. But that is sort of the transitional phase that happens in there around, like, say, the 1860s and so forth. A lot of this stuff that we would be, that would be the forerunners of modern technologies or, you know, direct antecedents doesn't really crop up until the 1870s or even the 1880s. So, for example, hydroelectric power, that's kind of the obvious one to talk about, right? You have a ton of existing water wheels and water turbines all over the country, you know, powering factories. They're, you know, providing mechanical power, turning, you know, gears, things like that, right? And unsurprisingly, this is a lot more efficient than a hand crank and probably more efficient than a horse-drawn or horse-pushed power generation. So if you can convert existing water wheels and water turbines to generate power, that's going to be a huge breakthrough. And in particular, this is where the United States really shines in terms of that breakthrough technologically at this point. In the U.S., this first appeared in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 1880. A chair factory's water turbine was used to generate power for a small number of nearby streetlights to help enhance the business's storefront component. And as an aside here, I should note that carbon arc lamp electric street lighting had been an available technology for quite some time. But this sort of gets into a chicken and egg thing, right? Which is that you need the technology to allow certain other technologies, but you also need to have the demand to drive the technological innovations. So these carbon arc lamp electric streetlights were pretty hard to implement in both the U.S. and Europe because of the lack of a power supply. So traditionally, for most of the 19th century up to this point, people used coal gas lighting instead for street or factory illumination. We actually mentioned coal gas in passing on our last episode about synthetic dyes, which is kind of a funny, you know, turn of events. You refine this inadvertently into a synthetic dye that has this vibrant color. Meanwhile, they're only just starting to figure out that, or hadn't even at this point figured out, the relationship between, you know, light and electromagnetism and so forth. And electromagnetism is going to end up being the thing that replaces coal gas lighting. But that's still further in the future at this point. In 1881, an existing flour mill at Niagara Falls had some of its turbine capacity reassigned for electric power to jazz up the site with lights for the benefit of tourists. And looking ahead, in 1882, a paper mill in Appleton, Wisconsin actually used hydroelectric power to generate enough electricity for plant operations directly, which is sort of the transition where you're no longer talking about a novelty use and you're now talking about a functional use that is powering the entire plant using electricity, right? And then you can start electrifying components within the plant and getting more advanced machinery. And dozens more of these conversions of existing hydropower happened across North America within just a few years. However, the first purpose-built hydroelectric dam was not until 1893, and that was in Austin, Texas. And this is from the Energy Information Agency website of the U.S. government that we found this. And as usual, we'll have the notes up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode goes live. So at this point, Rachel, we obviously have to talk about, again, going back to that chicken and egg issue, coming up with a thing that would, you know, you have to have the technology to be able to to power stuff, but you also have to have stuff you want to power to make it make sense to invest a lot in generating power, right? So you get kind of a catch-22 there, right?
Right. So Edison kind of created the thing that induced demand for widespread generation of electricity in the late 1870s, early 1880s, which outside of in-house factory power generators was previously pretty limited to acid battery-powered telegraph systems since the mid to late 1830s. And so Edison came on the scene with the innovation of a commercially viable light bulb and construction of grid-based power distribution systems in 1878 and 1882. And we will eventually come back to grid electrification and lighting in its own right in a future episode, but it's a huge topic, so we're working up to it. And also, as a side note, his work on light bulb design ended up with the Edison effect, in the first patent in 1883 of a quote-unquote electronic device, although that is a retrospective name and identification because electrons weren't named until 1897. And so prior to that, it was called a thermionic emission. There wasn't even a term for how electricity worked or electrons or electronics at that time. So kind of created the foundation for all those things. So the first large-scale central power station in America was Edison's Pearl Street Station in New York, which began operating in September of 1882. The station had six 200-horsepower, there's that horsepower again, Edison dynamos, which each powered by a separate steam engine. It was located in a business and commercial district and supplied 110 volts direct current to 85 customers with 400 lamps. And then by 1884, Pearl Street was supplying 508 customers with 10,164 lamps. So I just want to point out that, as Bill said earlier, there wasn't a lot of like residential application or demand for electricity at this time because they weren't putting lighting in their homes yet. So a lot of the demand was induced by commercial and business districts at this time.
Well, and also I think it's important to pause here and talk about this a little more. Again, to go back to that chicken and egg problem, is that up until this point, right, your electricity demand is either very limited battery electricity to run the telegraph systems, or you get these, you know, horse-powered or in some cases steam engine-powered factory dynamos, which are generating a little bit of power on site for either partially running certain things inside the factory or eventually, as we saw in 1882, actually powering the entire operation. But that's a very constrained and disconnected thing. That's on site, just in the same way that you didn't have central power for the telegraph network. You had battery packs, the arrays, the banks of battery cells lined up in a telegraph office. So everything was very decentralized and disconnected. There wasn't a grid, there wasn't central power, and so forth. In order for that to make sense as the model, you have to have some reason that you're going to be connecting up and linking up things. Now, of course, in a future episode, we can talk about the challenges associated with rural electrification, but in the urban environment, you still have to make that initial leap. You have to come up with some reason to have electricity going, you know, from building to building to building to building and being used all along the way and having customers. And in fact, as we'll talk about in another episode, you get a lot of demand problems even when you start having things like light bulbs because people aren't home all day, or they're not at the office 24 hours a day, or they're not in the factory 24 hours a day. Although factories, by the way, that was one reason that they got in early on the electrification, especially in Britain, was because they figured out they could have night shifts operating all the machinery and be that much more capitalist and profitable. So they were pretty enthusiastic about that kind of lighting. But you have initial problems where even when you start having, you know, everybody's home having electric lights, you still have to basically shut down the power plant during the off-peak hours because there's not enough people using it. And we'll talk about in the next, when we return to the electrification topic, we will talk about how they solved that problem. But when we're looking at this transitional period, right, the 1870s into the early 1880s, we're really zeroing in on the role that the light bulb plays. Now, of course, Edison is not, as we know, he's not the person who invents the light bulb, quote unquote, but he's the one who invents the commercially viable incandescent light bulb. And that is what is going to rapidly be spreading to people's homes. And that's going to, for the first time, make it make sense to have a power distribution grid system rather than generating it all independently on site. And we're also going to talk about, this is a little bit confusing, but you get, you know, those initial dynamos where you have a steam engine that's generating steam for the purposes of mechanical action in the same way that it would be, you know, moving a locomotive along, right? That's different from some of the later technologies that we'll talk about that are more similar to the, you know, the hydro turbines, which is, you know, you can use pressurized steam to actually turn your turbine, and that's a different process than having a more mechanical steam engine. I'm probably not explaining that very well because we are really reaching the outer limits of my mechanical scientific knowledge and understanding, as is the case with Rachel as well. But I'm just trying to draw various distinctions and parcel these out here so you can see that transition happening step by step. And it's very rapid, right? A lot of it is happening in the span of about 10 years or so, maybe 15, maybe less, depending on what you're looking at specifically. So in a way, it is kind of leaping forward, you know, in big bursts, but there's also these very clear and discrete stages and steps in this electrification process. So as you said, Rachel, Edison very quickly is promulgating lights everywhere, these commercially practical, not only home lights, but street lights and so forth. And it's not just in the United States, which is an interesting thing to remember, is that he was also quite a big player in the European market as well. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of that?
Yeah. So another big name in the electricity world, Nikola Tesla, was actually hired in Europe to install Edison lights, and he was quickly identified as a rising talent with an already very high level of relevant education. And the Edison company actually moved him to the U.S. by 1884. And once he moved to the U.S., he was a big player in electrification. I do want to make a note, although the first power station supplied direct current, as I mentioned before, the electric current only flows in one direction, the distribution of alternating current soon became the most favored option. So with the alternating current, I think we've all seen like the plots of like sine waves depicting electric current. So that's where the electric current periodically reverses direction. So if you're plotting it on a graph, you could just kind of see that wave, and that's alternating current. So the main advantages of alternating current were that it could be transformed to high voltage to reduce transmission losses, and that alternating current motors could easily run at constant speeds. So this becomes a bigger issue once we start expanding the grid. You don't want to lose all your electricity along the lines before it can reach its destination. So that alternating current is ideal for that sort of situation. And as we'll talk about in the future, that's obviously very important. Less so at this time when grids are relatively small, electricity is not really traveling that far from generation to its application, but it will be in the future.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the continuing evolution of dynamos before we actually get to the like Tesla's breakthroughs with induction motors and things like that and the AC currents? What are they working on in terms of turbines? Because again, we talked a little bit about the hydro that's happening around the same time, but what is this transition that happens with these spinning turbines to generate, which I guess is like a fundamental feature of a lot of electromagnetic power generation, is there has to be a spinning component because you're spinning magnets and things like that, right?
Right. So in 1884, in the UK, Charles Parsons came up with the steam turbine dynamo, and his technology arrived in the US via Westinghouse at their air brake facility in Pittsburgh, which we talked about Westinghouse and his air brakes recently. Although American-made competitors were already in use by 1895. So the steam turbine generator was the forerunner of the turbo generators that today provide most of the world's electricity. So it was the first experimental prototype produced in 1884, and Charles Parsons promoted the turbine as a smaller and more efficient alternative to the steam reciprocating engine. So in that, there's like valves and pistons that are moving, powered by the steam. And instead, he conceived of spinning a turbine instead of powering a piston up and down. So in the turbine, the expanding steam works continuously as it passes through many turbine stages. So basically, he's multiplying the power generation by however many turbines are included in this generator. So this gives far higher efficiency than was possible with the steam engine. And the turbine combines freedom from vibration with high speed. So in his prototype, he could reach speeds of up to 18,000 revolutions per minute, which is suited to electrical generators.
I can't even think of something moving that fast. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, it's pretty inconceivable. And he also was an avid sailor. He really loved sailing boats. And so he also used this turbine technology in marine propulsion. So in 1894, Parsons launched his first turbine-powered boat, the SS Turbinia, and with it, he could reach previously unattainable speeds of up to 34 knots. So it was really impressive how he could use his invention in multiple applications and to power his hobby that he enjoyed and kind of push the sport forward.
I guess this is the big kind of distinction, as you said, between like a mechanical piston steam engine versus this is like, if you're talking about 18,000 revolutions per minute, right? The drive thing on the locomotive is never going to go around 18,000 times per minute, right? Like, just not, it's not going to happen. Whereas this, you're really able to whip up those speeds. And at this point, I think we should talk a little bit about induction motors and things like that, because that ends up kind of being the practical application of these new dynamo technologies, right?
Right. So it's all about rotational motion, pretty much. So to kind of go back to the background, the kind of foundational knowledge that led to the induction motor. So in 1824, the French physicist François Arago formulated the existence of rotating magnetic fields. So he was able to demonstrate this principle with a rotating copper plate and a magnetized needle. So by rotating the plate, he could actually affect the direction that the needle was pointing. And so he showed the relationship of how this rotating copper plate affected the magnetic field and was able to act on this needle. And in 1879, Englishman Walter Bailey also demonstrated this principle by manually turning switches that caused a fixed electromagnet to shift its magnetic fields between four successive poles, and this actually caused a copper disc placed above the electromagnet to spin as it was affected by the rotation of the magnetic forces. So basically kind of applying the principle a little bit differently. And this spinning disc was the first primitive version of an induction motor. So what is an induction motor? It consists of a stationary stator that has coils supplied with alternating current to produce a rotating magnetic field. So that current actually acts on the stator to change its magnetic field. And then inside the motor, there's a rotor that is attached to an output shaft that actually produces a second rotating magnetic field. And this rotor magnetic field may be produced by permanent magnets, reluctance, saliency, or direct current or alternating current electrical windings. I can't really explain that super in depth, but just basically the two different magnetic fields are acting on each other, and that creates an electrical current. And that's pretty much the extent of my technical knowledge. There's several videos on the Wikipedia page for induction motors that kind of help demonstrate the principle in a way that's not always easy verbally to understand. So an early single-phase induction motor was created by Hungarian scientist Otto Blathy. And a single-phase induction motor does not have a unique rotating magnetic field. So with Bailey's motor, he actually was changing the magnetic field between four poles. And then with a single-phase motor, it's just reversing polarity. So it's not really rotating as much as it is just switching back and forth. So a secondary magnetic field is needed to actually determine the rotational direction for the rotor, because otherwise it's just kind of flipping back and forth. It doesn't really have a way, a rotational direction until you apply a secondary magnetic field to it. So his major innovation is that his motor didn't require any switches, unlike Bailey. Bailey had to manually switch on and off the electromagnets to control the current and its movement. So Blathy's motor didn't require any switches or commutators, as they're known, to keep the magnetic fields rotating. And it's kind of funny, his invention was later used for the purpose of electric metering, which is obviously important for future power utility purposes, but at the time, I'm not sure how useful it probably looked at the time. There wasn't an application for it yet for electric meters, which today are just digital, but back in the day, you could see the wheel spinning on your electric meter. So that's how that worked. The first alternating current commutator-free polyphase induction motor, so that's where the rotating magnetic fields are moving in a circle along various different axes. This polyphase induction motor was independently invented by both Galileo Ferraris and Nikola Tesla, a working model having been demonstrated by Ferraris in 1885 and by Tesla in 1887. Tesla applied for U.S. patents in October and November of 1887, and was granted some of these patents in May of 1888. In April 1888, the Royal Academy of Science of Turin published Ferraris' research on his alternating current polyphase motor, detailing the foundations of motor operation. And in May of 1888, Tesla presented the technical paper, A New System for Alternating Current Motors and Transformers, to the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. And he described four stator pole motor types, one having a four-pole rotor forming a non-self-starting reluctance motor, another with a wound rotor forming a self-starting induction motor, and the third a true synchronous motor with a separately excited direct current supply to the rotor winding. So he was able to kind of take both the existing direct current knowledge and kind of marry it to this alternating current innovation. And interestingly enough, George Westinghouse, as we mentioned earlier, was also developing an alternating current power system of his own at the time. And he licensed Tesla's patents in 1888 and purchased a U.S. patent option on Ferraris' induction motor concept. And Tesla was also employed for 1 year as a consultant at Westinghouse. Westinghouse employee C.F. Scott was assigned to assist Tesla and later took over development of the induction motor at Westinghouse. Steadfast in his promotion of three-phase development, Mikhail Dolivo Dobrovolsky invented the cage rotor induction motor in 1889 and the three-limb transformer in 1890. So there were several people working on different models and different makes of these induction motors at the same time. Mikhail Dolivo Dobrovolsky furthermore claimed that Tesla's motor was not practical because of two-phase pulsations, which prompted him to persist in his three-phase work. And although Westinghouse achieved its first practical induction motor in 1892 and developed a line of polyphase 60 Hz induction motors in 1893, these early Westinghouse motors were two-phase motors with wound rotors until B.G. Lamb developed a rotating bar winding rotor. And again, there's diagrams on the Wikipedia page for induction motors that kind of demonstrate these different terms in a way that it's hard to convey. Another concept that was kind of happening at the same time was onboard auxiliary power for passenger trains using the steam power that powered the train for electricity functions inside the train. And this is happening kind of on a parallel track in the 1880s. So first, the North British Railway in 1881 successfully generated electricity using a dynamo on the Brotherhood steam locomotive to provide electrical lighting in a train, a concept that was later called head end power. High steam consumption led to abandonment of the system. Three trains were started in 1883 by London, Brighton, and South Coast Railway, with electricity generated on board using a dynamo driven from one of the axles. This charged a lead acid battery in the guard's van, and the guard operated and maintained the equipment. And this system successfully provided electric lighting in the train. In 1885, in continental Europe, electric lighting was introduced in trains in Frankfurt using a Mohring type dynamo and accumulators. The dynamo is driven by pulleys and belts from the axle at speeds of 18 to 42 miles per hour, and at lower speeds, the power was lost. So this is kind of a common problem with these head-end power systems. It all really depends on the train being in motion and generating power. In 1887, steam-driven generators in the baggage cars of the Florida Special and the Chicago Limited trains in the U.S. supplied electric lighting to all the cars of the train by wiring them to introduce the other form of head-end power. However, oil and gas lighting provided a higher intensity of light compared to electric lighting and was more popularly used until September of 1913, when an accident on the Midland Railway in Aysgill in Britain caused a large number of passenger deaths, and this accident prompted railways to adopt electricity for lighting the trains. And throughout the remainder of the age of steam and into the early diesel era, passenger cars were heated by low-pressure saturated steam supplied by the locomotive, with the electricity for car lighting and ventilation being derived from batteries charged by axle-driven generators on each car, or from engine generator sets mounted under the car body. Starting in the 1930s, air conditioning became available on rail cars, with energy to run them being provided by mechanical power takeoffs from the axle, small dedicated engines, or propane. The resulting separate systems of lighting power, steam heat, and engine-driven air conditioning increased the maintenance workload as well as parts proliferation. Head-end power would allow for a single power source to handle all those functions and more for an entire train. And as we talked about, trains were able to go faster at this as the technology progressed, as the air brakes, Westinghouse air brakes proliferated. So trains were getting better and better all the time and able to generate better and more consistent power all the time. So this became a more attractive prospect as the technology developed.
Yeah, so a little bit of a side tangent there, but, you know, kind of didn't really fit in with a lot of the other stuff and starts in the same time period that we're ending on the 1880s. As we said, you know, there's a bit of a battle after 1888 or so and into the early 1890s about, you know, direct current versus alternating current. As we know, it gets resolved in favor of alternating current. But we are going to stop the discussion there for today, because this was really sort of, as I said, a preamble or prologue leading into that huge wave of electrification, at least in the cities in the United States, that becomes synonymous with phase two of the Second Industrial Revolution. But we felt that it was important to go over sort of the early electrification, the very limited applications of electrification in the industrial history of the United States, even with a bunch of non-American scientists doing a lot of the heavy lifting there. And so that's why we talked today about the developments from electrochemistry to electromagnetism leading up to the end of the 1880s. Rachel, did you have any closing thoughts on this?
I know this kind of laid a lot of technical foundations, but I think in the future, episodes, it's going to focus a lot less on the technical aspects and a lot more on how it got applied and how it got innovated. So I think even we kind of had to slog through this terminology and these technical explanations, but I think it'll get a lot easier in the upcoming episodes.
Yeah, and admittedly, we could have gone even further with this and started talking about like copper mining and stuff like that, but I figured we had to draw the line somewhere. So I hope this was useful as I said, stage setting, groundwork, foundational material for the upcoming electrification. But, you know, we've been doing this industrial history stuff now for, I guess, what, more than 2 years, and it felt like it was probably time to stop putting off some of the electrification topics and stop talking around it.
Yeah, exactly. The Industrial Revolution just couldn't happen without this innovation happening before that.
All right. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on this week to talk about this.
Glad to be here.